You're here, and what's happening in the country at the moment?
Well, I'm here because we're all facing a massive catastrophe, the whole population of the world. And my particular concern is that Britain, amongst all the countries in the world, is a particular responsibility because of the role of British multinational corporations. If you look at the top 20 companies in Britain, four of them are mining corporations and three of them are big oil and gas corporations. So in a sense, people of conscience who want to do something about climate change have to also see what our own corporations, or rather corporations based in our country, are doing. I'm just back from Colombia, and I was with a group of us, and some people are still there. They're traveling around the country. What I did is I went to visit indigenous people in the Sierra Nevada, which is in the north of Colombia, and then I went from there to visit a massive open cast coal mine in La Guajira region, also in the north of Colombia, and then went to the capital, Bogota. And they held a series of public hearings over the last 2 years because there is no justice within the Colombian state system itself in terms of trying to control the impact of multinationals and their exploitation, either of the environment or of the local people. And so social movements themselves have organized for public hearings to draw attention to the multinationals in Colombia. And the first one that we attended was on the impact on indigenous peoples. And about 500 indigenous peoples met together in the Sierra Maestra. And it was a wonderful event. There are about 90 different indigenous groups in Colombia. And 18 of them are facing extinction because of the impacts on their way of life. As massive incursion of natural resource seeking multinational corporations into the Andean region and into the Amazon part of Colombia. And in particular in the south of Colombia, which is the Amazonian region, there's a massive impact now of driving out indigenous peoples from their traditional way of life. Secondly, as I mentioned, I went to La Guajira, which is a big coal mine. And this coal mine is owned by three corporations, two of which are ex-South African corporations now based in London. One is called BHB Billiton, the other is Anglo-American. And they make enormous profits. They have got a dedicated railway which is shunting out hundreds of carriage loads of coal. But again, there's massive social and environmental impacts. We interviewed African descendant people who have been forced off their land. We interviewed indigenous people from the Wayuu who live in an area which is completely surrounded and controlled by the mine, and they're very, very demoralized in a very difficult situation. And so we're supporting them and drawing attention to the other side. I mean, people talk about clean coal, but I mean, it's very dirty coal in the sense of the massive ecological impacts and the social impacts in bringing the coal out of Colombia, for sure. And this coal makes enormous profits for the corporations concerned. It costs something like about £23 a tonne to produce, and they're selling it on the world markets for about £100 a tonne at the moment. And very, very little of that, a mere trickle of that, gets back to the people whose natural resources they actually are. And then the final port of call was in Bogota, as I mentioned, where it's a culmination of about a three-year program where they've been looking at the impacts of multinationals in terms of their public services, in terms of mining, as I mentioned, in terms of biodiversity and oil. And all these results were brought together. And the people in Colombia are really fighting two allies who work closely to support each other as their enemy. One is the Colombian government, which really invites foreign multinational investment as their concept of development relies on this, and then the multinationals themselves. And what we really think is the campaign is that we need to make a people's alliance between us, who are against the impacts of the multinationals and climate change here in Britain, and the social movements of Colombia and the rest of the Andean region. So in summary, it's a great, great event. This, I've already seen how wonderful and how self-organized and how motivated the people are here. And in many ways, it's very similar to being with the social movements in Latin America. It's the same spirit of daily resistance, the same spirit of making to want a change for the better now.
Great. Fidel, do you want to answer the question and report back?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. I came here to learn a lot about the environmental fight and struggle that you do in England. And I came to share as well my experiences and to share with you what's happening in Ecuador. Listening to Andy, a lot of similarities are between Colombia and Ecuador until now. I mean, the biodiversity of the countries in the Andean regions is one of the highest biodiversity in the world, but also the interests of multinationals for the natural resources of the region is very, very high. And right now, the situation, the political situation in Colombia and in Ecuador is completely different. And I think that makes very interesting that Andy and me have the opportunity to talk together to make some kind of comparison of what are the alternatives for the developing countries to avoid the deforestation, the devastation that are being that are suffering for years and years and years and decades. Ecuador right now is going through a very deep structural change. We are just rewriting a new constitution that's going to be on the referendum in about a month and a half. And from the environmental point of view, it's very, very revolutionary and interesting constitution in Ecuador. Just to give some examples, it's the very first constitution in the world that is recognizing the rights to the nature as itself. In the Andean cosmovision, the Pachamama, which is translated as the Mother Earth, yeah, is something that lives, yeah, has a life, and that's why Ecuadorians have decided to give rights to the Pachamama, to the nature. So, if the constitution is approved, any citizen in Ecuador will have the right to sue any company or any individual that is attempting against nature, against the national natural reserves, etc. The constitution in Ecuador is forbidding the privatization of natural resources, the privatization of water, the privatization of oil, the privatization of mining. Yep. So in that case, is a very interesting case. And in Ecuador, during the last decades, there is a very strong environmental movement that luckily is being part of these new initiatives with the current government. I will share with you here in the campament a very unique initiative that is being launched by Ecuador, backed by the Ecuadorian government, which is also a civil society initiative, which is basically how to aims to keep the major oil reserves of Ecuador, and Ecuador is an oil dependent country, underground. Yeah, looking for some compensation from the international community, basically saying the north has an environmental debt with the south, and we are making a sacrifice not to have the revenues that we should have for the oil exploitation, in order to keep the biodiversity, in order to keep not only the major reserves, oil reserves of Ecuador, but in order to keep and touch one of the major biodiverse places on Earth, where some indigenous communities are also on the verge of extinction. So there are a few very interesting initiatives that I would like to share with you all here. And as I said, also I'm coming here to learn from you. Mm. because you are doing an admirable work.
Can I just ask how this came about, do you think, in your country? I mean, for instance, the changes in other countries in Latin America, like Venezuela and Bolivia, they're very much social driven, obviously, like socialism, right? But how has that expanded into environmentalism in Ecuador?
Well, Ecuador is trying to go out from a complete collapse, politically collapse, economical collapse, but I can say also environmental collapse. Being one of the most biodiverse countries in the world has also the highest deforestation rate in South America. And in Ecuador took place, for example, an environmental catastrophe by Chevron Texaco Oil Company, which is considered by experts to be probably the biggest environmental catastrophe next to Chernobyl. If you heard about Exxon Valdez a few years ago, this is 30 times bigger. That happened during 28 years. Nobody knows much about it because it happened in the jungle. Nobody knows much about it because the oil companies had the support from the previous government. But right now, for example, the communities affected by this catastrophe are suing the company, Chevron Texaco, in something which is known as the sue of the history, because Chevron Texaco will have to pay something like $16 billion to the communities. That is 30,000 people, indigenous people and communities that organize and are suing and it's also the first lawsuit that is taking place in a developing country that will force a multinationals to respond to our justice. And that was directed by the U.S. Supreme Court, that they have to respond to our laws. So after economical collapse, after political collapse, a very strong citizen movement came out with an alternative, saying we can't have the same economical model. We can't have the same model of exploitation of nature. We need different rules. We need to reform the country based on new rules. That's why we are rewriting the constitution. And as part of the movement are also the traditional social movements in Ecuador, such as the indigenous movements, so are the environmental movement, and we won the elections. We won the referendum for the new constitution, and we are doing very well with these proposals.
Okay, I'm aware you have to rush off to go and do your workshop in a few minutes. So basically, I'd just like to give you a chance to give some last responses before you go. So Andy, would you like to add anything that you've to respond to what Fidel said?
Well, I think that the cosmovision and the experience and the moral as well as political impact of the indigenous movement in Ecuador is certainly something which is far greater than, say, in Venezuela, although I think Venezuela has got a very progressive policy now towards indigenous peoples. In Ecuador, I think the indigenous movement is sort of central to everything, and you very much get that as well in Bolivia, and I think that is the connecting link that you're sort of looking for, because in a sense, indigenous people as a guardian of nature and, if you like, acting as a representative of rights of nature in society is something which we're beginning to see more in Colombia as well. It's a very interesting process, and it's quite contradictory, I have to say, as well, because the Colombian constitution on paper is quite progressive regards indigenous people, but on the other hand, if they get in the way of the multinationals, then they've got a problem as well. And so there's a real fight going on. And it's a great hope in Ecuador and also in Venezuela and Bolivia, I think, for the region and for the world. And so, you know, there's very good news coming out of the region, thankfully.
Fidel, anything else?
Well, basically inviting everybody to come and listen to the workshop. And recommending to join the camp. It's very, very exciting experience, and it's really worth coming here and joining the struggle for better world.
Okay, great. Do you just quickly announce your websites if you've got them, and then we'll go to the program.
Andy?
Ours is called ColombiaSolidarity.org.uk, and Colombia is spelt with two O's and no U, and you'll find it. Okay.
Well, ours is quite long. I think it's www.movimiento, which is movement in Spanish, Ecuador, as it sounds, dot UK?
Mm-hmm. Maybe an org.
maybe org.uk. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Okay.
We're just going to play into track now.
The rip from the earth, right next to the slave castles where the water is cursed. From where police brutality's not half as nice, it makes the hood in America look like paradise. Immortal technique, LDK, Green London, third world motherfucker. I'm from where the golden diamonds are ripped from the earth. Right next to the slave castles where the water is cursed. From where police brutality's not half as nice. Third world motherfucker. I'm from where the golden diamonds are ripped from the earth. Right next to the slave castles where the water is cursed. From where police brutality's not half as nice. It makes the hood in America look like paradise. Compared to the AIDS infest, the Caribbean slum. African streets with a passport's an American gun. From where they massacre people and try to keep it quiet. And spend the next 25 years trying to deny it. I'm from where they cut your hands off if you make a fist. A nigga stole coca cause the job market doesn't exist. Except slave labor, modern day company store. And peacekeepers don't ever, ever, ever come here no more. From where the bombs that they used to drop on Vietnam still has children born, deform 8 months before they gone. I'm from where they lost the true meaning of the Quran. Cause heroin is not compatible with Islam. And niggas know that, but grow that poppy seed anyway. Cause that food rap parachute does not come every day. I'm from where people pray to the gods of their conquerors. And practically every president's a money launderer. From where the only place democracy's acceptable is if America's candidate is electable. And they might even have a black president, but he's useless cause he does not control the economy, stupid. Lock and load your gun where I'm from in third world. Son to many places, but I'm third world born. Gorillas hit and run where I'm from in third world, son. You polluted everything and now the third world's gone. The water's poison where I'm from in third world, son. 700 children died by the end of the soul. Revolution will come where I'm from the third world, son. Constant occupation leaves the third world torn. I'm from where the Catholic Church is some racist shit. They help Europe and America rape this bitch. They pray to white Spanish Jesus, whose face is this? But never talk about the black Pope Galatius. I'm from where Soviet weapons still decide elections. Militaries like the mafia, you pay for protection. Catamite sex clauses with the country sells. And rich white businessmen make the best clientele. I'm from where they too pussy to come film Survivor. And they murder Coca-Cola union organizers. I'm from where the justice system is not podrido. Fuck government, niggas politic over perico. Rebelde conocido, enterrado vivo. Como otro argentino desaparecido. Cause RICO laws don't apply to the CIA. And motherfuckers make sneakers for a quarter a day. I'm from where they overthrow democratic leaders. Not for the people, but for the Wall Street Journal readers. From where blacks and de-races against themselves. In a place they was raised and you kept us caged in. Destroyed our culture and said that you civilized us. Raped our women and when we were born, you despised us. Gentrified us, agent provocateur dividers. And cruise dictators can keep quiet. Fuck your charity medicine, trying to murder me. The immunizations you gave us were full of mercury. So now I see the third world like the rap game soldier. Nationalize the industry and take it over. Lock and load your gun where I'm from, the third world. Son, into many places, but I'm third world born. Gorillas hit and run where I'm from, the third world. Son, you polluted everything and now the third world's gone. The water's poison where I'm from, the third world. Son, 700 children died by the end of the song. Revolution will come where I'm from, the third world. Son, constant occupation leaves the third world torn.
Grimy sword is fractured.
Invasion. Immortal.
fucking liquor store, dog. I need another bottle of Jack.
Hold on, wake this motherfucker up, man.
Yo, Cynic, wake the fuck up, man.
Testing.
Test. Test.
Yeah, we're on. And we're here with Brett Broccoli from Ready, Steady, Skip, which is such a fantastic program. Can you tell us about it?
Okay, well, the idea started when there's quite a strong skipping scene, a dumpster diving scene in Nottingham. We were all skipping a lot of food and often finding too much food for ourselves, so we were sharing them out with other houses, taking veg boxes around to our friends' houses, sharing the breads and cakes and things we found. And it was just in conversation, it was in our heads, how can we share this with more people? And the idea to do a spoof kind of TV show came about, and then just the joke with the play on words of doing an episode of Ready, Steady, Cook. So
yeah, we had two teams. So we came up with the idea to have two teams.
Which were the yellow broccolis and the brown bananas.
Yep, and both teams went out into the city in Nottingham to forage north and south of the city, went to two sets of skips, found loads of food all in a morning, and then we'd built a studio in about a week.
It's an abandoned police station in Nottingham. And we built a full TV studio. We had really high quality lighting and video cameras, all zero budget. Everything just came together fully autonomously.
Yep, everyone just came together and sorted it out themselves. And we, I'm Pete, by the way. I sort of helped produce and direct it
and edit, which was a ridiculous job with.
And we filmed it in front of a live studio audience with all the food that we'd skipped. We had this big cook-off and we cooked these two amazing meals. I mean, basically, this film, the reason why we're talking about it now is because the world premiere is going to be here at Climate Camp tonight.
Woo!
Woo!
In Scottish and Newcastle at 7:30-ish, get there for, probably film beyond before 8 o'clock, 7:30 to 8.
Yeah, between 7:30 and 8, Scottish and Newcastle have got a little cinema down there. And they're being really helpful, and they're going to show it for us. So come down, watch it. It's really entertaining. It's full of craziness. And come and see the amount of food that people throw away. It's absolutely astonishing.
That's right, Pete.
And now's his. We're just going to play the soundtrack, hopefully. Bit of a drum and bass remix of Ready, Steady, Cook.
Yeah, because it can't get any cooler.
Live and direct, coming at you from the radio station in the house.
Hello, yeah, this is Neil from Climate Camp Radio. I'm here with Matt in the animal rights tent in the camp, which is located in the East Side neighbourhood. We're here talking about animal rights and climate change, and I'm just curious as to how you ended up as an animal rights activist at a climate change camp.
It's always seemed to me, as soon as climate change became an issue, that as an animal rights activist, there really couldn't be a bigger animal rights issue than climate change. If we succeed in our activities as animal rights activists and get legal protection for all animal lives, that could be made completely irrelevant by catastrophic climate change, which could kill the majority, if not all, life on the planet. So it was obvious to me that it was necessary to forge links between the animal rights movement and the eco-action movement, and in this case specifically the climate camp movement. But it also seemed to me that we were all fundamentally on the same side, just coming at it from different angles, because after all, surely we all want to find a way to change the paradigm of permanent economic growth, and to move towards a more ethical and sustainable way of living on this planet and in harmony with this planet, rather than the disastrous policies that we pursue at the moment, which are just grinding it into money and destroying everything.
So, yeah, the animal rights movement as one separate movement and climate activists as another separate movement, and you're trying to forge links between these two movements, and is that that's your angle on things, is it? Yeah.
I think links are always a good thing, particularly between like-minded people. I'm certainly not trying to forge some sort of one-party state. The more groups, the merrier, and as far as I'm concerned, each individual is almost a separate political party as and of themselves, by virtue of the fact that everything you do as an individual that extends its consequences beyond your own person is a political action. But yes, I think we need a movement for radical change, or whatever you want to call it, towards ethical and sustainable living, and that should include at the heart of it, as far as I'm concerned, the concept of animal rights, the concept that if it is wrong to abuse and exploit, torture, mutilate, maim or murder a human being, then it must be wrong to do the same to any other animal life, on the basis that we have all evolved from the same source on this planet, and we are all, be it however closely or less closely, we are all related.
Okay. And how have people been responding to your presence at this year's camp?
I have been highly, highly gratified by what's happened at this camp. I've been forging links with people in the climate change movement and in the sort of related Earth First movement over the last two or three years, made many good friends. Last year at Heathrow, I found it somewhat different. There was a lot of resistance to the fact that, given the statistics, really, you really did need, as a climate activist, to consider the idea of being vegan. A lot of resistance last year. This year, response has been positive, really, really positive. So many people have come up to me and said, we're really glad to have animal rights here. So many people have come in and asked for information about becoming vegan or recipe books. But not just that, really the whole concept of full animal rights. So to me, that's a movement towards an ethos in which we do base our personal interest, not in ourselves, not even in our species, but in what is best for all lives on this planet. I think that way we can have an ethical and sustainable future.
Okay. And for the uninitiated, could you just give us maybe a couple of ideas about how using animal produce and animals does affect the environment?
Well, I do try not to trade in statistics, and also what I would say to you is I'm not really the person to talk to about how it affects the environment. I will talk to, I know that it does affect the environment. I'm not trading in statistics, but I think it's 17% of emissions for livestock farming and 13% of emissions for all transport systems, so that's pretty self-obvious what that means. But I'm just trying to persuade people that what is ethical and what is sustainable needs to be seen as one and the same thing if we are going to develop a new paradigm, a new way of living, an alternative that we can put to the state, that we can, well, at least show the state, that we can put to any individual to show that a future in which we need to downsize our energy requirements and in which we need to move away from killing and eating other animals is not a future of austerity, but is a positive, life-affirming future which is good for all of us.
Okay. And obviously you're here at the camp this week and having a nice time, but it sounds good. But what other activities would you be involved in terms of animal rights?
Well, as this is going out over the radio, and I believe it's on the internet, and as an animal rights activist, I think I ought to stay fairly quiet about that. But let's say that I support all activities that oppose the abuse and exploitation of any animal life, and anybody on site who's interested in coming up and finding out about that, please come and visit us in the animal rights tent, and I'll be only too glad to talk off the record or about whatever you want to talk about.
Okay, excellent. And do you have some workshops coming up at the camp?
Thank you for saying that. Yes, we had a fantastic workshop today. We had the Radical Action Group Sea Shepherd, who go down to the South Seas and show Greenpeace how to really stop the Japanese killing whales. At least 60 people in the animal rights tent for that workshop. Very positive, very well received. We have what we call the Animal Rights 1 o'clock workshop, which is in the lunch hour. Get some good vegan food, come to the Animal Rights tent. Tomorrow we've got someone from Viva talking. Very good workshop, which I think everybody on site, whether into animal rights or not, needs to come to on Thursday, which will be about the sort of policing that governs animal rights and which is now increasingly governing eco-action behaviour, which is a NETCU watch. So the National Extremism Tactical Coordination Unit. And police officers policing this event all carry its little book. They are the people whose rules are being applied in the policing of this event, and I think people should come along to that workshop and find out what's really going on.
Okay.
There will be other workshops on Friday, obviously not on Saturday, and I'll be doing one on Sunday. If I could just say finally also that I have got a personal climate camp workshop, although it's been moved from Space F because Space F wasn't built, to the animal rights tent at 12 o'clock tomorrow, Wednesday, entitled Animal Rights is the Beating Heart of Eco Action, and hope to see people there.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Matt. I hope to, I might actually pop along to that and give it a listen. Okay, thanks very much.
That would be great. It's a pleasure. Hope to see you.
And we're back live in the studio, and I'm sitting here with Francis from our wonderful Climate Camp legal team that does so much stuff for us. Could you tell us what's going on, perhaps some information for our climate campers?
Well, I've got a collection of announcements, and I'd also like to update people about the stop and searches. So, after the mass walkthrough yesterday afternoon, searches stopped for a period and resumed with some increased intensity later on in that evening. Mm-hmm. We've just had a shift change, and they're being particularly creative, let's put it that way. So, we're planning another mass walkthrough, possibly later on this afternoon. Meanwhile, they're doing all they can to get names and addresses using Section 50, alleging people have stolen their own wallets or stolen their own phones in order to get their names and details. So if anybody would like some quick advice before they go out, then come to legal. And I think that's probably all I can say on the stop and searches. Clearly, they are unlawful. They should not be generalising and searching everyone under Section 1 of PACE just because we're going to the climate camp.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have enough legal observers at the moment to cover all the areas? Or are you still training up people? Because there's workshops happening every day.
There's a workshop officially in the booklet at 2, although I think we've announced it as being at 4:30, so there's possibly 2 going on this afternoon.
Okay. Great. And thank you for coming in and speaking with us.
I've got three announcements.
Three announcements.
We've got 3 people in custody at the moment. We'd like any friends of Sean Howard to come into the legal tent as soon as possible. And we'd like anybody who'd like to write or otherwise support Paul Morozzo, who's currently in Wandsworth Prison, and his prisoner number is XF9301. He's in court in Selby on Monday. And if people want more information or ideas for support, could they go to the Yorkshire neighbourhood where there's a table set up?
Great. Thank you very much for coming in and telling all this to us, keeping us informed. And we're going to go straight into an interview with Andy, who is a local resident. Where do you live exactly?
I live approximately 3 miles from the Kings North Power Station in Villiers of Wainscott.
Oh, cool. Interesting. And you are a climate camper, is that right?
Indeed I am. I'm also a spokesman for a group of people, we call ourselves Kings North Climate Action Midway, and we are totally against the ridiculous policies proposed for the Hoo Peninsula in the form of a new coal-fired power station.
How many people from the local area are here, would you approximately say?
It's difficult to say. There's a lot more than what we thought they were.
Yeah.
They seem to be coming out of the woodwork at every available opportunity.
Good stuff.
I would say there's probably about 30 of us so far.
And it seems like there are lots of people coming in regularly from the local community just for day visits as well. I was talking to some people yesterday.
Indeed there are. I was at the front gate of the camp last night talking to residents that were popping in and out of the camp. Mm-hmm. And they have actually requested from us a presence in Hoo, because they feel that their rights to come to a climate camp are being oppressed by the heavy police presence.
Oh yeah, definitely. It seems like they're keeping us in, but we can't forget that they're also keeping the locals out.
That's right.
It's just ridiculous to make a day visit to go through all those checkpoints. And so what kind of response has the local community had to climate camp? What would you say?
I think before climate camp arrived in town, there were mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. I think this was largely due to lack of facts on the part of the general public. This has been largely due to E.ON's fairly effective PR exercise, which is aimed at keeping people in the dark and keeping them without possession of the facts in which, you know, with which to make up their own minds about what is proposed for the local area. I mean, it's not in E.ON's interest to inform people that we here in Medway have the 3rd highest rate of childhood asthma in the country and the 4th worst air quality in the country. It's not in their interest to let us know these things. They try and counteract what they're doing and try and excuse their ideas for the Hoo Peninsula mm-hmm. on the basis of supporting community projects mm-hmm. and asking people misleading questions in PR polls.
Interesting. And so how, perhaps you can tell us more specifically, how would the building of King's North affect the local community in terms of health and the economy, and perhaps you can go into that a little bit?
Well, the health of the area, I mean, when you want to talk about that, you're talking about being locked into another 50 years of a perpetuation of an existing problem. Those of us that live locally all know about the Hoo cough, the mysterious cough that you develop when you've been on the peninsula for a short period of time that mysteriously disappears when you leave and then returns when you come back home again.
Oh, that's awful. And are there any sort of perceived benefits that are being touted by the media or by the PR from Eon in regards King's North and the local community specifically? Like, I'm sure there are some locals that are kind of in opposition to Climate Camp and do support King's North. And what sort of things are they talking about?
I think the general thing that we're talking about here is employment. I mean, obviously there's employment at the power station, and then there's the kind of peripheral support infrastructure in forms of cafes, etc. Yeah. But what people are failing to realise that our government has actually committed us in Europe to 40% of renewables by 2020. And if you look at that, and then you can make a comparison with Germany, they get 10% of their energy to the grid from renewable sources. And that has created 235,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. And these are sustainable jobs. The proposition to keep coal as part of the energy mix mm-hmm. means that we are confining ourselves to a finite industry, mm-hmm. which doesn't actually make any logical sense.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And do you know if the council is going to try and come visit and see Climate Camp? Have you guys been in contact with them?
Yes, there has been a member of our local council on site. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, he was at the disturbances at the rear access to the camp, and whilst trying to defuse the situation with the police, was unfortunately knocked to the floor by riot policemen. So, yes, the council are quite interested from that point of view, and there is support amongst the local councillors for Climate Camp, seeing as their hands were tied over anything to do with decisions to build King's North. Mm-hmm. They were only a consultory body mm-hmm. in as much as they could only look at the building regulation implications for King's North, but couldn't object to it in any way whatsoever, which is a despicable thing. There has been no democracy mm-hmm. On behalf of the local people to say, no, we don't want to perpetuate the problems of King's North within our community. And therefore, those of us that have a social conscience and wants to do something about it are at Climate Camp. And it is the feeling of myself and the members of the group that as many people as possible should get themselves along to Climate Camp and see what it is about. It's not about a standoff with the police. It is about education.
Yes.
It's about building a social movement to enlighten people as to what is really happening and what coal-fired power generation really means in real terms of climate change mm-hmm. and health effects on the local environment.
Yes, thank you for that. That was great. And moving forward, this isn't the end, obviously. When Climate Camp moves out, you guys are left here. And are you guys going to be planning on it, doing any actions, demonstrations, and looking for support and
We're looking for as much as support as we can gain from the local community. We currently have a petition which has, I think at the moment, we have approximately 2,000 signatures mm-hmm. on this petition. And our aim is to actually deliver this petition to Downing Street at some point after the camp has gone.
Mm-hmm. And how about any sort of direct action-oriented demonstrations? Anything in the works, possibly?
I think that sort of thing is still under discussion at the moment, because as a group of local people, we're not particularly in favour of breaking of any laws. But what we do wish to do is draw attention to the fact that our democratic right mm-hmm. To actually have a say in the infrastructure that goes into our community has been ripped away from us, and we are prepared to use media and other similar things to draw attention to what we're trying to say, that no, King's North is a bad idea.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us today, and I wish you the best of luck in any future campaigns.
Thank you very much.
And we have some announcements, actually, to make on a daily basis. I think the shout-out time should be about now, right?
Shout-out time! Oh, yeah. Woo-hoo. I had to grab me a mic for this. I just want to do a shout-out to the Bobs. You know who you are. It's a group of fantastic people who were on the back of a train at Drax, kicking ass. Some of them have been seen, some of them have not. But basically, as a result of people doing direct action, the police are being incredibly overhanded and politically led in relation to banning people from the camp, which is all about education. The right to free assembly is being overridden and trodden on by these people. So I just wanted to give a big shout out to those who can't be at the camp and say we're thinking of yous, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, and this program is actually brought to you by several radio stations, one of which is Rise Up in Nottingham, and obviously Dissident Islands, of which we are big fans. And then there are also two other ones.
Flash Radio. And we've got supporting us on site, we've got Bristol Wireless. Yeah. Big shout out to them. A lot of love from them. And if you're listening over the internet, we need to give a big thanks to who's providing that, which is plentyfact.org. Yeah. And they've been helping us out an awful lot in supporting us with the technical expertise we require.
Excellent. And it seems like our friends in the sky are back, so we apologize for the unnecessary background noise.
We'd like to apologize for the waste of fuel that they're using to annoy us.
It's sort of ridiculous, but...
And the £2,000 an hour of taxpayers' money that we are being flauntingly wasted.
That's ridiculous. Okay, so just to remind everybody that if you do want to do your own recording, not only can you stop by the radio tent and talk to us about picking up a recording device, but there is a number you can call, and that is 020-704-33783. And then you listen to one of those menus, and your option is number 6. And basically what you're going to be doing is leaving a recording, and you can do an interview in the fields when you're on an action, and just we will get that file and we can use it in the future. And now we're going to go into an interview with one of the bail breakers that Patrick did.
Hi, this is Neil with Climate Camp Radio. I'm here with Mel, one of the bail breakers that entered the camp yesterday to cheers and applause and a couple of dodgy songs. And we're in the camp, and we're just going to chat about, first of all, why were you on bail, Mel?
Okay, so about 2 months ago, a group of 29 of us essentially hijacked a train. We stopped a train on its way to Drax coal-fired power station, where the climate camp was 2 years ago. In the UK, there's a whole separate network of railway lines, which are just for coal, they're not for public transport. And so we, at 7:30 a.m., took a train on its way to Drax, stopped it using safety procedures, and we've made our own climate camp on it, basically. That was our intention. We had tents for toilets, and we had enough food and had sleeping bags and had everything we'd need to survive as long as we could, basically. And so we had it for about 15, 16 hours until midnight the following, the midnight of that day. And the bail conditions that were put on all the people who were involved in this were that we couldn't come to climate camp.
Some other conditions as well, which are slightly more curious, I found.
Yeah, it started out that we were going to have to... A condition would be we would have to reside at our bail address, so we would have to sleep, and effectively it was kind of like a house arrest. That one got dropped last week when it was challenged, so that was really good. But people have tried to challenge the climate camp bail condition, and it hasn't been successful. And obviously we feel like, of course we should be able to come here, we need to come here to make dinner, we need to come here to meet people and talk and take part in discussions, take part in workshops, do everything that is the climate camp. And so we can kind of accept this condition that we can't go on power stations because, you know, I mean, we can understand where that's coming from, but in terms of coming to climate camp, that's just too far. We got to be here.
I think there was another one that you're not allowed on a train without a valid ticket. Did you get that condition?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, because, like, otherwise that would be acceptable, so, yeah.
Weird one from the judge there, I guess. They were thinking about something that, I don't know.
That was some kind of gag that we weren't aware of. That was just whoever was saying the conditions was like, you never had a ticket for that train.
So, you got your conditions, when was it, a couple of weeks ago, or whatever, you were up for bail?
No, it's been over the course of the past sort of 10 days that everyone's been receiving their conditions. So the reason why I'm doing this interview with you now is that actually I'm going to get my conditions tomorrow. So there are a few of us who, in solidarity, were publicly, you know, stating that we are going to breach bail, which, according to some people, makes us just as, you know, there's just as much potential for us to be arrested. However, yeah, that's not happened.
Okay, so you're not going to go to Leeds tomorrow, or you are?
I am going to go to Leeds tomorrow, yeah, because not showing up for your bail is like, then there's a warrant out for your arrest, and that, yeah, gets a bit messy. Yeah.
And you're going to come back and see us?
I'm so coming back. I'm going to try.
Yeah. Give it a bang. And why have you, like, do you feel that, I mean, you said you didn't have any argument with the power station in this one, that's kind of, you're not allowed in a power station, you're not allowed in anyway, it kind of makes sense. Why have you got such a problem with this? I mean, I don't agree with it, but I can see from the point of view of them that they just want to keep you away because you're a troublemaker.
Well, I mean, obviously, the biggest troublemakers are E.ON, like, there's no question about that, and the government, thanks. But I guess it's that way where, you know, on Saturday, the day of action, there's going to be so many people taking part. Like, you know, it's going to happen. It's about mass action. That's about, you know, just the force of numbers, like, and the power of that. And so there's so much stuff that we can do in support on that day. Then in terms of the camp, it's like, you know, I think it's about challenging that notion that this idea that is being put out there that everybody involved in the camp is just criminals. Like, we wanted to defy that, and just say the camp is about so many things put together. There's been so much focus on lawbreakers, and, you know, to just kind of bring those things together. It's like, yeah, we do direct action because we've tried other things and they're not working, and we want to get to the root of the problem ourselves. Can I get that?
Okay, so you decided to make this bail-breaking exercise a bit of a, well, publicity. You got some publicity, I read about it in The Guardian, for example. I mean, how did the whole process work out for you?
I guess, you know, we wanted to do it for ourselves because we wanted to. But, you know, it got to a point at the end of last week where we were all like, we just want to go to climate camp so much, you know, we've been thinking about it and dreaming about it and planning for it. We just want to go, we can't accept this thing saying that we just can't go. So we decided that we were going to go, but we also wanted to make a public statement about that, as I say, to defy this notion that we're somehow unreasonable, you know.
Domestic extremists.
Yeah, you know, it's like extremists are the people who want to build coal-fired power stations in the face of climate science, in the face of recommendations from scientists across the world, in the face of, you know, the opinions of a broad base of people across the UK, you know. So many people want to see real action on climate change, not see all their efforts undermined by massive decisions like this one that the government and E.ON are making, locking us into carbon emissions. So, you know, we wanted to stand up and publicly defy this condition that had been set and say, no, this is really, really important. This is the event of a generation and we have to be there.
Did you get much coverage?
Yeah, I think we did. I think we got a fair bit.
Where?
Like BBC and Channel 4 and ITV and Independent and Guardian and various local ones all came along on the journey with us. We're on the bus with all these media people entertaining some of the other people who were just on the bus ordinarily, who were just like, why are there all these cameras on the bus? And on the train on the way from London, we randomly met this peace activist couple who were North American and Australian, who were like, oh, it's so great to hear people talking about direct action. That's what we had to do about the Vietnam War. Generations missed it, but now you're doing it again. That's great. And we told them about the Australian train hijackers who'd, you know, followed on from our action at JAX a couple of months ago, who'd, you know, I don't know if you heard about it, but taken over two trains that take 10% of the world's coal in and out of Australia. So, you know, it was great to make those links in that journey.
So it sounds like it's been a very positive experience.
I wouldn't say that, to be honest. Like, it's been sort of daunting and scary and worrying and concerning, and someone really, really amazing has been taken away, got arrested, and, you know, on their own. We didn't get to stay together, so I think when we climbed over the fence, even though it was amazing to be welcomed by the camp and great, it was just like continually worrying and sort of upsetting that we weren't all together.
Okay, well, I'll leave it at that because I know you want to run off. Okay. thanks very much hopefully see you at Barrier.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
Hey, welcome back. Hope you all enjoyed that. Rock on the bail breakers. Fuck the system, man. Especially when it's as unjust as the system we operate in. But on a positive note, on a positive way to do things, I had the pleasure of being here with some lovely people from Rising Tide. Hey guys.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
We're all well. Little sweltery in this tent,
yeah,
but it's going really well. So you're from the Rising Tide Network. Now that's an international network of grassroots activists. Do you want to tell me a little bit about you guys? What do you do?
Well, yeah, we're an international network of climate action. So we're a network that uses networks of communication via email or telephone to link up and do things on an international level, on a national level, and also on a local level. So we help each other out with propaganda. We produce publications telling facts about things, and in solidarity with different places and people that are interested in fighting climate action in the same way as we are. So.
Cool. And you do a lot of little side projects and all that. But I was reading that one of your core aims is to fight for social justice in relation to climate change and a lot of the environmental issues with that, which is one of the reasons that you're one of the groups signed up to the PGA Hallmarks.
That's right, actually. Well, actually, just a bit of tiny bit of history, because when we got going with this in about 2000, there were a lot of NGOs out there, mainstream NGOs, that didn't really talk about social justice and equality. There were many groups in the global south that did, and we kind of allied ourselves more with those movements than some of the northern-based NGOs that were still separating the environment on one side and social justice on the other, when of course it's pretty apparent that they're all inextricably linked. But yeah, we are part of the People's Global Action mobilization, and the hallmarks of that are very powerful, I think, and they've been quite adopted by quite a lot of people around the world. Some people don't like them, but we're quite happy to have them. This commitment to direct action and confronting the system and taking direct action.
And you don't do lobbying either.
Well, it's an interesting one. Some of the things we do have a lobbying element. We just have to watch out that it doesn't take over. Because sometimes you're lobbying for one small thing to happen, but if that small thing happens, then it can sort of dislodge something quite powerful in the system. So
chipping away at it, I think, is what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
but you have to sort of monitor that quite closely, I think.
Cool. So you as a group, you have these sort of backing theories and ethos behind what you're doing. So in relation to the international element you've mentioned in solidarity with the majority world, really, Global South as well, and what sort of area base do you cover? I mean, how global are we talking?
There's one group in Portugal, isn't there? And is that disbanded now? There's groups in Australia, and also I think we've got 15 or 16 groups now in North America. Is that right? Something like that. There's quite.
I don't know the number, but we've had two climate camps over there to help with the rising tide. People have been helping out with at least two.
And they've done a rising tide tour of North America. But yeah, that's quite exciting because there seems to be a lot of different groups that are either now affiliated with Rising Tide or part of the Rising Tide network, which is really exciting.
Well, in the US, they have a very strong desire to connect more closely with Latin America and Mexico. Similarly, we have that desire to connect, as I said, with those who are struggling at the sharp end of oil and gas and coal exploration. But it's, you know, the situations out there can be so hard, it's going to be quite hard to maintain contacts with those movements. But we do have some quite exciting connections coming together, particularly in Latin America and some of the indigenous mobilizations in Ecuador, which are resulting in the government initiative to ask the international community to pay them not to take the oil out of the ground. But that's as a response to all these global, these indigenous movements saying, this is our land, sacred space, you're not coming in. So we're trying to, you know, we want to show solidarity with what they're up to.
Excellent. Now, I believe Rising Tide, although having many different affiliations throughout the UK, Europe, North America, Australia, I believe you've other side projects as well, such as Art Not Oil, I hear.
Oh, yes, that's right. I'm a bit hoarse, partly because we had an Art Not Oil workshop this morning, which went extremely well. Shall I explain what that is?
Please do.
Particularly in London, there is an infestation of oil companies in cultural institutions. Cultural institutions means sort of big galleries, museums,
theatres. National galleries?
National galleries, yes, they have the national elements, but the oil companies pump money into these institutions, partly because the richest, most influential decision makers in London go to them. And the oil companies don't want those people to come out and say no to oil. So they sponsor shit. Am I allowed to say shit on the radio?
Fucking
oh
A.
Oh my God! This is truly the underground. Wow. And so we created this initiative, which was to take direct action on that situation. And because, in a way, those places are where the companies are more vulnerable than they are on their forecourts. Shell sponsoring the National Theatre and making a fuss there is, you could argue, is more powerful than just shutting down a petrol station, though, of course. I wouldn't discourage you from doing that if that was on your mind. So we create a grassroots exhibition, which has traveled around the UK, and it's now mostly online. We helped kick Shell out of its sponsorship of the Wildlife Photographer of the Year exhibition, and we're looking to create a... In our workshop today, we discussed how when it was tobacco companies sponsoring the National Portrait Gallery, it became eventually unacceptable for tobacco money to go into these galleries, and then that created a kind of wedge. And actually now in this country, we have a situation where the government is completely working against the tobacco industry, pretty much.
From a sponsorship point of view.
Well, from starting from sponsorship, but now from going from a smoking ban and not having advertising and all those things. So actually I didn't even think of this myself, but it was quite exciting to think that if we were responsible partly for getting an oil company kicked out of a gallery, which you could argue is a relatively small aim, it could actually
but it
be
is a success. I mean, you say it's a relatively small aim and a success, but it is actually a success because the National Portrait Awards have now refused to have Shell as their sponsor, so it came to the end of the 2-year contract.
The Natural History Museum. Yeah, that's very true. But of the fact that could be a wedge, and that actually eventually you could see governments turning around and saying, ending their kind of really intimate relationship that they've had over the decades and decades. So that was quite exciting.
All right, cool. So these are just in relation to Rising Tide itself as a group with many diverse locations, let's say, and diverse projects, etc. What sort of other things do you guys get up to?
Well, one of the most exciting things for me is the International Days of Action. I find that really, really great to know that you're not just a small group of individuals, but you're actually a small group of individuals working together with other small groups of individuals worldwide, a lot of groups in the UK and then the other groups in places that we've mentioned. And that is just brilliant because you're all doing it on the same day, focusing on either the same theme. I mean, we had an International Day of Action against Royal Bank of Scotland last year because they're one of the largest financiers of fossil fuel industries. And that was a great success. You had a lot of actions for that. But when you're actually doing one of those international days, over the day, you kind of get reports of, oh, North America have done this. Oh, they've shut down another power station. And you get reports of what people are doing in different places, which is really empowering. And I think it also shows that as a network, we can be voices talking together about issues that we think need confronting, rather than just a small group of voices. When it's really empowering to know that there's other people doing that thing on the same day, all doing it together. That's what I really enjoy about Rising Tide.
Now, you mentioned the Day of Action Against the Oil Bank of Scotland, and another fantastic idea you guys had was the Fossil Fools Day, which was the 1st of April this year.
Yeah, that's right. That was
you, Katia.
That was really actually good fun.
A couple of other people out in the US had been doing that, but the Rising Tide over there thought it would be a great idea to make that happen, and we kind of jumped on board here in the UK quite energetically. And we put the word out all over the place via really nice little viral cards with a cheeky jester in silhouette saying... what was the slogan? Or did we cut the slogan? Was that too cheap? Was that too naughty? I can't remember.
Too expensive for printing costs. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we didn't want to offend any tender sensibilities. And eventually people liked the idea, because partly at the heart of what we do is a celebratory element to it, a cheeky, turn the world upside down element, theatrical, bit of that stuff. And so a lot of people got on board with that, and there were many, many tens of actions in the US, probably about 25, was it, in the UK, something happened in South Africa.
It was actually in the mid-30s.
It was in the mid-30s.
Website.
Yeah, definitely more than 30.
And we're not talking about the temperature, ladies and gentlemen. Although today it could be in this tent.
In this tent, definitely.
Okay, so I hear a vicious rumour that another Fossil Fools Day is being planned for next year.
It's a sweet-natured but rather cheeky rumour.
Yes. As of yesterday, we've decided that it was actually so much fun having a bit of tomfoolery whilst pointing out the facts behind climate change and the purveyors of climate change, the climate criminals. We had so much funding, and it was such a success, and it was so well received, that comedy element to pointing these climate criminals out, that yes, we are definitely going to do Fossil Fools Day next year.
The jester is back.
So watch out.
And now he means an end to business.
Cool. So the Rising Tide Network now, you guys seem to be pretty on it, and you're growing out there. Where should people go to find you? They so desire.
You can go to our website, which is www.risingtide.org.uk if the UK, or just .org if you want to check out the international website for different things going on in different parts of the world. So yeah, have a look at the website, read our political statement, and drop us an email if you're interested, or look out for up and coming Days of Action and join in.
We've got groups, active local groups around the place, and some local contacts in places where it's just about too hard to get a local group together. There are still some contacts out there that you can get in touch with and go, hey, maybe you and me together can change the world. Yep.
We've also got a monthly newsletter that tells you different, not just Rising Tide actions, but different actions on the fossil fuel empire, or different actions surrounding climate. So there's other local groups as well that feature in those newsletters, not just Rising Tide. So check out the newsletter as well.
And London Rising Tide has its own website, so I hear. And I think that's londonrisingtide.org.uk.
It is.
And going back to the art, not oil, tip.
Just starting worse now, come on. Bristol's got their own page on the website.
Oh,
when do we get our own website? It's not fair.
Art, not oil, you can find at artnotoil.org.uk.
All right, cool. Something I meant to say earlier, which I just wanted to promote about the Rising Tide group, which a lot of other groups aren't, is that Rising Tide is an anti-capitalist group as well. And I think that's...
Didn't we say that?
We can definitely say that, because
we didn't say that.
Enough
I thought
of
we
it
did.
Out there these days.
That's right. We're very excited because we've got a new leaflet out, and it's flooded the camp, and it says, capitalism, the elephant in the room, and we're really kind of very committed to making sure that that message stays at the heart of our analysis and our actions, and hopefully that leaflet would help that to happen.
All right, well, that's wicked. Thanks very much, dear. Is that Nels for me?
No, and it's been a delight, as always.
Yes.
Cheers, dear.
Thanks all for right. having us.
All right.
Can I say... No, no.
All right, we're just going to rock into a track now, so we'll catch you after.
testing. Okay, we've got an interview with someone called Sky, who was at the 2001 Genoa G8 summit, where there was a lot of violence from the police, and many people got hurt. And so he's going to... The interview with him is briefly about what happened, but then mostly about the court case and basically the fact that they won.
Yeah, my name's Mark Covell, otherwise known as Sky, to my friends. I was an Indymedia journalist at the time of Genova, the G8 summit in 2001, and you know, this G8 should everyone should read up about it. It's part of the movement's history, and it's also part of the history of the climate camp here, believe it or not. Anyway, cut a long story short, I was badly injured, almost killed, during the Diaz raid, where 93 protesters and journalists were sleeping in a dormitory. We were raided by 340 Italian police, which left about 12 of us with very serious injuries, about 50 moderate, and the rest were taken off to Bolzaneto. I ended up with a broken hand and 8 broken ribs, damaged spine. I lost 16 teeth, and I was put into a coma for 2 days from an attack. I mean, Daniel Thomas Albright, he was another person, he ended up in a coma. In fact, the prosecutor's office described Diaz that there were 7 attempted murders by the Italian police there, which had been under investigation, you know, since that raid that night. I was then transferred to hospital, San Martino Hospital, where Colucci, the chief of police, tried to drag me out of there and take me to Bolzaneto. But I was lucky, I managed to stay there with a few of us, but the majority were sort of like kidnapped and dragged out of the hospital and taken to Bolzaneto. At the time, I had very little idea of what was happening at Bolzaneto, but it turned out to be Italy's Guantanamo Bay. Over 200 people were tortured over the space of about 48, 72 hours by Gomai, by our prison penitentiary staff, and by the Carabinieri. In fact, Amnesty described it as Genova and Diaz and Bolzaneto as the largest suspension of human rights since World War II in Europe. So, after a lot of international furore and investigations, we were released, but we were still under investigation until 2003 by the prosecutor's office. But by that stage, 2 years after the raid, the prosecutor's office was also investigating the police. And in September 2003, 76 Italian police were indicted for human rights abuses, planting false evidence, conspiracy to pervert the course of justice, and also torturing people. These fell into 2 main trials, Diaz and Bolzaneto. Diaz had 29 commanding officers and men on trial, and there were 47 for Bolzaneto. The Diaz trial has much higher officers involved, like, for example, the chief of the anti-terrorist squad. He's on trial for commanding the raid, and he's also going to be indicted for my attempted murder as well fairly soon. So, now, the trials, both the trials, they started, in 2005, have been ongoing for about 2.5 years. We Bolzaneto was just finished a couple of weeks ago. We obtained, of the 47 people that put on trial, we obtained 15 convictions, including the commandant for Bolzaneto. He got 5 years. Mm. Other famous cases, Agent Pigozzi, he threatened to rape all the women at Bolzaneto. He'll be going to jail as well. I mean, I think he got 2.5 years. We've got, quite a few women prison staff have been indicted for this. Doctors as well. James Toccafondi, we refer to him as Dr. Mengele. One of his favourite pastimes was cutting off the hair of women prisoners
and
then keeping it.
It
was quite sadistic about that. He was also sewing up wounds without any anaesthetic and also joining in on beatings of protesters and stuff like this. So with Bulls and Airtel, we got 15 convictions, which is good. We also got the court awarded us €15 million compensation to all 209 victims from Bulls and Airtel. With €2 million of that being paid out in emergency compensation next month. But we have to wait until we win the main Diaz trial before everything gets released in terms of compensation next year. We also won corporate responsibility against the Interior Ministry, which is a very big deal. I mean, that's equivalent, like, for example, the Paddington rail crash finding, Department of Trade and Industry guilty, of crimes of corporate responsibility. So it was important to get that. Now, in the main Diaz trial, we've had, the prosecutor's office brought sentencing requests against 28 of the 29, totaling just under 110 years that they're facing in jail. So for that, I'm very happy at the moment. It's not enough. Some of these cops should have faced far higher sentences, but the problem is it's the Italian law, it's the system there. It really goes against you, so they can only like hand out sentences of, let's say, 5 years for bringing in, and planting Molotov cocktails at the school, for example. It's not enough, but hopefully with Diaz we'll also get a little bit of extra money, like €7 to €10 million, so we should top out around €23 to €25 million in compensation for everyone concerned.
Has there been a public apology from any of the police?
Of course not.
And
they have barely even acknowledged they've committed a crime. Some of the cops did testify. I mean, one of them, Fornia, described Diaz as a Mexican-British shop. So this is like how far we've got in them understanding their crimes. I mean, if they were to say sorry, admit to the enormity of their crimes, and serve their time, I would accept their apology. And I hope that there's progress for Italy, but I know that's not going to happen.
So you wanted to talk about the up-and-coming G8 next year as well, yeah?
Yeah, La Maddalena. What's currently happening is that the next G8 is going to be in La Maddalena in Sardinia. Every 7 years the G8 rolls on and, to its next member, so like Italy is next up. And obviously with Liga Nord dominating northern Italy and putting in a strategy of tension and a lot of security arrests and fingerprinting of immigrants and Muslims and stuff like this, it's going to be a very hard time for protesters going to La Mad. Now with La Maddalena there's also going to be the Sardinia Control G8 Assembly will be set up. That's in its process of being set up at the moment. It's going to be a round table of around 80 people that will be making all the main decisions about how and when people protest in Italy. I do very much hope that everyone at Climate Camp A listens to me and also listens to the Italians when they go there, and they listen to the plans for the La Mad G8, because if you don't listen, it will get you killed.
So you don't think they've changed the government and the police attitude, because this is such a big court case, they haven't it hasn't had an impact on them?
Well, we've had a big impact on them, but it won't make any difference for La Mad. Unfortunately, due to the statute of limitations, none of them will serve time in jail. And unfortunately, the same Diaz police defendants will be on duty during La Maddalena. They are just interested in killing protesters. They're not interested in negotiating. In a way, we're in a situation that's worse than Geneva at the moment. Right. So, I mean, for me, I'm trying to marry up and sort out the situation between, trying to get Kyoto to, agreed at this La Maddalena G8, so it then gets signed at Copenhagen at the UN process afterwards, whilst trying to keep the police defendants away from the island, and so the movement can peacefully demonstrate, because at this stage it does not look good. There is a strong possibility that the G8 could move to the Italian mainland. The problem with La Maddalena is there's a United States naval base there for a nuclear power submarines, Right, I mean, it's old and disused now. They vacated 2 years ago, but they left a load of plutonium waste exactly on the spot where the G8 is meeting. I mean, we could pray and hope that they do meet there, and when the meeting finishes, they go away glowing in the dark. But yeah. Probably what we should take away from this is that the G8 will probably move to the mainland. Berlusconi wants Naples, Liga Nord want Milan. If it comes to the mainland, it'll be a lot easier for the movement to get to.
Mm.
Okay, so, anyway.